I'm expecting.
Welcome to the Reinvent Health Podcast. I'm Nikki Robertson, and my guest today is author, journalist, literary agent, and writing coach, Sarah Bullen. In this episode, we discuss her latest book, The Other Side, in which she seeks to uncover the mysteries of life after death, following her own near-death experience. This book features stories of people who've been to the other side and returned, and others who can communicate with life beyond the physical realm. You can buy both Love and Above and The Other Side at all book retailers, as well as online. To find out more about Sarah and her mentorships, go to sarahbullen.com. Sarah, after going through what can only be described as a forever life-changing experience, you clearly wanted to understand more. And the new book, The Other Side, speaks to our yearning to connect and to know. I think there isn't a human being on this planet who hasn't wondered, no matter what our religious background and our upbringing is, what is on the other side? So let's just briefly explain where this all originated from.
So the book really started about over a decade ago, back in 2012. And what happened in 2012 was quite an extraordinary event. My husband had been battling cancer for 4 years. And at the very last month of his life, I ended up getting a chest cold out of nowhere. I was 36. I was fit. I was healthy. I had two young children. I was running a publishing company. I was working with authors all over the world. And I got a little tickle in my throat. And within 48 hours, I was in ICU. I was on life support in an induced coma and fighting for my life. At the very same time, in a strange and weird twist of fate, my husband was in the last month of his life. And what happened to me was quite extraordinary because I was to remain in that coma for a month, 3 weeks to be exact. And during the time in the coma, I actually went on a very extended near-death experience. That story is quite extensively detailed in my previous book, Love and Above. But what happened is I came out of the coma. I fought my way back to life. That journey itself is quite a long story detailed in the book. Mm-hmm. And I woke up from the coma. My husband passed away a few days later. And at that point, it was just a crazy fight for life. I was trying to learn to breathe again, to walk again. I was trying to rehabilitate my body because being in a coma for a month, you have no muscle tone. You have to learn to walk, sit, breathe, move. So my husband had also died. So there was just this crazy frenzy going on around us. We were young. We were both kind of well-known in the industry. I was an author. He was a filmmaker. There was a huge load of attention and excitement around what had happened. And my own near-death experience kind of faded away because something so much bigger had happened, which was a death.
Yeah.
I got on with life. I found my way back to life. And then I completely, a year later, changed my life completely, which I'll talk about a little bit later. I went on a madcap adventure. Yeah. And then what happened was things just ticked along, Nikki. And because I'm an author, people said to me, Sarah, write this crazy story about your coma, about your husband's journey. And yeah. I just couldn't. But 10 years later, yeah. 10 years later, I was starting to ask a lot of questions. And the questions were really around, firstly, what actually happened to me? Mm. Why did I fight my way back from a 2% chance of survival, from being, you know, declared dead for 24 minutes? Not just why, but also how. And that's only the beginning of when I started to talk about this near-death experience. And that's when the questioning began and the conversations with other people and the looking and the who else has had this in Southern Africa? Who are they? And can I gather their stories as well and talk to them? And that was the beginning of the book.
So, I mean, I picked up your book. I think it was the first day it was launched. And I think it took, like the first book, about 24 hours to finish it because it's so engaging. And the problem is it doesn't answer questions. It just inspires more questions, which is, I think that's what this whole subject is about, because we don't know the answers. But I have to, and there's lots of themes I want to discuss today, but the one theme that really stood out for me was, and I'm going to quote your interview with Dr. Nokozulo Mdende. That's right. And she said, no one is
Wonderful.
irreligious. Every person is a bearer of spirituality, and every individual belongs to a larger community. And that almost like blew me away because obviously we are so interconnected, but we've lost some innate wisdom. We've lost the interconnectedness. And on my other shows, we're always talking about the importance of community and why we are suffering a mental health crisis is because there is no community and there's no connection. But the theme that really stood out for me in all of these stories that you weave together, taking other people's experiences as how we are all the same. And that was so beautiful to actually, firstly, how did you go and start looking for these people? And what really came through for you as the common thread?
The search was a difficult one, initially because I wrote Love and Above. And when I wrote Love and Above, I didn't think the near-death experience would be the highlight of the book. I thought it would be the whole journey because it was such a big story. But what I found as I started to do talks all over the world and podcasts and radio and TV interviews was the thing most people were interested in was the near-death experience. And that's when I was invited to speak at near-death experience conferences. And every time I got on stage, potentially there were other people who had had one, but the questions that were coming at me were so fascinating and so searching and so yearning for answers as to what I saw and what was there and can it be in their lives that they make this connection. So I had easy access to find stories, and the reason being that's my work. I work with authors, I'm a literary agent, I'm quite out there. So actually what happened is the stories came to me. They came via people grabbing me after a talk and saying, "You won't believe that, Sarah, this happened to me too." Or it came through an email, or it came through a phone call or a Facebook message. Because I'm a journalist and my primary training is in journalism, I decided to pull them together. And I wanted to be quite rigorous in the pulling together of stories. So I had eventually a form I asked people to fill in because I wanted stories that were quite verified near-death experiences. And it turned out most weren't. Most weren't. So when people hear the word, "I had a near-death experience," many people think it means I nearly died. And that's not actually what it is. It's not like I escaped death in a car accident. It's actually a person who has clinically died or approached death, and their soul has left their body, and they've gone through a series of tick boxes that are checklists for what is a near-death experience. And it's really scientifically calculated and measured. We don't tick all the boxes, but some of those boxes happen. And I really then, Nikki, decided to tighten my focus and ask the question, are experiences in different cultures different? And I focused myself on Southern Africa. And you've picked up on exactly that. Exactly that. Are they different? Not so much. The experiences are different. And I'm not going to jump into my conclusions yet. The experiences may visually be different, but what people found, there was such a common heart in all of those experiences. So the stories found me, and my job really was to gather them, to gather the stories, to check that they were accurate, and then to go and choose the select people that I really wanted, the extraordinary stories, because I really was looking for extraordinary stories of people who had seen things, done things, experienced things that were unusual, unorthodox, out of the box.
Makes sense. So when you went through this interview process, it looks like because you break up the book into three segments. You've got the near-death experience, you've got the out-of-body experience, and then you've got the plant medicine experience. But there's a thread between all of those as well, which also pulls it all together. So what was going through your mind when you started getting in these stories? And goodness, I mean, regardless of background, religion, age, where you are in the world, there's a theme, which I think is just uncanny. And I think that's also what makes us want to know more. But I suppose my question is, where did you start? What was it that prompted you to start sorting the near-death experience from the out-of-body experience versus what we are seeing such a growth of in plant medicine?
So that's really interesting. So when I wanted to only focus on near-death experience, but there just weren't enough. There were not enough people that I could find, that I could verify, who had actually in Southern Africa had proper near-death experiences outside of YouTube videos and rumor. And I think that happened to me. So I expanded my search, and the next category I included was that out of body or an epiphany. And this has really also had to be quite rigorous because an out of body experience is a very, very formal thing. I'm going to put the word formal, where during a very heightened moment, there's an experience of leaving the body and having a conversation with a higher being. Okay, so these were the tick boxes with that. And I found such extraordinary stories of people who hadn't had to have to die to connect with some bigger wisdom, innate wisdom, divine wisdom, whatever words we want to use. But in the process of the gathering, I just met the most fascinating people. And one of them said to me, "But Sarah, you live in a continent where you are so lucky, where there are people who have this unbelievable relationship with ancestors, with the bigger picture, with the other side. And it's not just a distant one, they live with it." And I decided to look a little further than people who had to die or have an extreme experience to connect to this wisdom. And that's why where I included part three, which is people who can talk to the other side. That journey was quite extraordinary because I have got in the book, I've got a Kabbalic Jewish rabbi who has herself had near-death experiences, but is also a seeker, a seer. She is a psychic medium. I've got a non-duality teacher who connects with the other side. She too is a medium and she also had a near-death experience. Then I have sangomas, which in South Africa and the Southern African tradition are people who of the ancestors who can speak and communicate. The one that most people are very interested in, which is where we can all access, is the plant medicine.
Yes.
And this is really interesting because plant medicine is one of the ways that the layperson, and I say layperson because these other modalities are accessed by a priest, a shaman, a magic person, the psychic, a medium. They're people with special gifts. But what I found plant medicine has allowed, it's allowed an ordinary person not to have to die and come back, not to have to leave their body and come back in a traumatic event, but to be able to take a plant and have a little insight into these worlds that other people can traverse. So I included that and I chose very specifically an African plant. So I chose iboga, ibogaine. All of the other plants are South American or they're from other continents. So I wanted to really be tight and specific and choose a plant that came from the African continent. So that's, I have an iboga shaman who's trained for many years, taken 17,000 people through plant medicine journeys into what is called, and this is a really crazy chapter of the book, to meeting what he calls the God of the Dead, who is Bwiti. Bwiti is the god that stands behind the plant iboga. So these plants often have presences behind them. And so that's a crazy chapter. That's a chapter that I still get shivers when I read. It was a strange experience. It was foreign to me. And yet, I totally understood it on a soul and heart level of what was happening when you go through these crazy experiences.
You've got a very strong skeptic mind, and I've had my own experiences. I love these books. I can resonate with them on many levels, but that skeptic is always sitting there. So when you were interviewing and when you were speaking to people, even though you've been there, you've seen the other side, how loud was your skeptic and how was it working for you or against you?
It was there. It was absolutely there. And the skeptical mind, I often call like an intelligence as opposed to the heart pull, the mind pull versus the heart pull. So I brought it in full force. So what did happen was in a number of the interviews, I intellectually understood that this was not what I was looking for, that the person hadn't had the kind of mystical experience. And at the same time, there was also just a knowing that when I was talking and interviewing each person, the people who really had been and there and had had that experience, there was a knowing that this had happened because the conversations were similar. There's a feeling. So I was quite rigorous, to be absolutely honest with you, and I can't put that aside. And you're going to find that throughout the book as well because my narrative voice, I am narrating that I'm going to each person, and I insert that. I say, I'm not so sure that this is was a near-death experience, but it was really was something that is irrefutable in the sense of that something happened. So I believe that it's incredibly important to have that voice. I also interviewed a lot of people who work in the world of scientists, doctors, who kind of brought a different kind of insight into the very mystical conversation. Because what we're having here, this book is not about science, even though there's so much science packed in there. And it's this complete duality all the time in which science wants to prove it, but it can't quite prove it. And at both at the beginning and both at the end, I say it's so frustrating. It's frustrating even for me, having had a mystical experience, a near-death experience. I have a knowing, but can I prove it? I can't. Can
No.
anybody categorically prove what happens after we die? They can't. Not after centuries, thousands, millennia of searching and
Yeah.
asking and wondering and trying to travel into the great beyond and try and come back. Proof, we don't have.
No.
Belief,
Yeah, exactly.
is there.
But I mean, the brain is a sense-making organ. It's a sense-making organ because it's there to keep us safe. So if we can make sense of the world, we feel like we have some kind of control over a world that we know we have absolutely no control in. And I think I think why reading these stories is so attractive is because it makes it okay not to be in control of everything. I think there's a big part of the human brain that is yet to be discovered that doesn't want to control for everything and has maybe there is a frequency there that lines up with the frequency of the unknown that can tap into this other side. That's how we access it. And I think it is just yet to be, maybe it should never be proven because I think mystery is really, really important. For humanity and the unknown and the what if is so part of human nature and so part of our need for wonder that perhaps we shouldn't know. We should always really, exist in the what if and the wonder and the story and the fantasy because that's what makes us happy. So yeah, it is such a push-pull. There's so much push-pull going on in all of these stories. And what you said earlier is there's doctors who are so rooted in the science, but they get the other side. It's so beautiful.
So, yes, absolutely. So, just in terms of the doctors, a lot of the doctors who work for some of these bigger institutes and research, they're
Yeah.
neurologists and neuroscientists, and so they hold both of those. And yet there's this, they know, they proved. I mean, they in the University of Virginia, they're documented. So many people have died on operating tables, and they've tried, science has tried so hard to understand what it is these people saw. And we've got categories and we've got these tick boxes. But the book begins, Nikki, picking up on what you said. And it is really, it is a huge search in this generation that we're in. It's this huge search to want to know what's on the other side. And it's rising and rising. It's rising through our plant medicine. It's rising through there's online, and I quote them, there's online courses. Mindvalley has courses on how to access altered states and astral travel. And so there's such a deep desperation in the human spirit to understand. And at the very same time, we're seeing the very big decline in organized religions globally. Young people moving away from organized religions. So there's this huge searching for soul connection, and there's also moving away from the place that you held it for a very long time, which is religious practices. So it's quite a difficult place that the humans are in. So what we're doing, and this is not, necessarily a trend, is we're looking for that in our peers, in the plants, in the rituals, in the ceremonies, but we're taking it out of context. And I quote Karina Lyall. She's a First Nation teacher, and she speaks about her generation. She has a Becoming Nature podcast about it's an extractive culture. So plant medicine is usually deeply rooted in community, and it's a way that they understand life and that they move through moments and celebrate things. But we're extracting it now. We're doing this ritual to try and get others, but we're not rooted in community. So we're grabbing at things, we're looking for things, and we're packaging them, we're pastiching a whole load together, we're trying them. And it's really interesting because there's this huge drive to just peer into. We don't want to wait for the. We don't want to wait. We want to know before
We want to know what
our
happens.
time is over.
Yeah, we want the spoiler alert.
We want to know what happens.
Another theme that really came up is, and I'm sure this happens all over the world, but it was very pronounced in your book, is how many African people will be or can be Christian, but still understand that they have ancestors and that there's ceremony and that there's African tradition around speaking to, respecting, invoking the ancestors where appropriate, but still we're Christian, or we have, a structured religious basis as well, and how we can allow these two to exist in the same place, which is that unusual in other parts of the world, or does it exist?
It absolutely does exist. And you are going to find that many indigenous cultures have a duality. They hold two practices. They hold the indigenous practice, which is very small. It was built up through a village and through life experience and through the land and through animism. But what has happened, and this was really interesting for me, was when the big colonizing religions came in, particularly in Africa, Christianity being the biggest colonizing religion, those indigenous smaller village practices were deemed uncool. They were deemed bad and demonized. So a lot of that was kind of made out to be negative. What I found, this was really interesting for me, but particularly in the chapter with Godfrey Madlatle, who is the one of the heads of the Traditional Healers Association, and he's a very he runs a huge clinic in Soweto, is that actually up to 70% of these traditional healers are Christian as well. So they are both religions, whereas there's a lot of long held through colonization, through the other, dare we say, apartheid, where they were pushed out the way, even to the place where people rooted in those cultures believe that. So that was a huge eye-opener for me. And it really goes back to, and I really found this, Nikki. I did find this, that people who work with spirit or soul or the higher organizing concepts, it's very universal, whether it is non-dual, or it's Kabbalic Judaism, or it's Christianity, or it's animism, or it's indigenous practices, or it's Hindus, as some of them were. There's a huge, bigger holding thing. And I begin the book with a quote from Taz Singh, who is a psychic medium, and she comes from what she describes as a staunch Hindu family. And it starts with a quote that there is something really big out there. And that holds true. That holds true, apart from in the non-duality, which I'll speak about maybe in a little bit, because the non-duality believes it's out there, but it's also inside. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere and nowhere. And that's when the mind starts to do flick, flacks, and tricks, right?
Go deeper into the non-duality.
This was really interesting. And, when I sat with so many people over about 2 years chatting about near death and the beyond, somebody asked me what was the one conversation that landed the deepest. And I think it would have been the one with Colleen Joy Page, the non-duality teacher. Colleen speaks, and she herself has had a near-death experience. She herself was psychic back in her youth and used to have a psychic practice. The question she asks and she raises, she describes these epiphanies, these wonderful, like mind-blowing, these plant medicine trips, these near-death experiences as Hollywood moments in the search, in the seeker's search for connection. And the question she asks is the search for something out there, or is the search something for something? What if it's not out there at all? What if it's already in there, that we're searching for that moment, but it's not actually all Hollywood? Most of it's quite ordinary. And that was sort of after many of the conversations, that was the one that really had my brain and my heart and my soul doing complicated flick
Yeah, I can
flacks.
imagine.
And I think that is the point of non-duality. It's taking apart the concepts that there's anything or nothing, that it's this or it's that. And I think that is the point of it. And I'm still grappling with that. I'm still making my way, my head, my heart around it. But it landed, it landed, it landed.
It's really hard for the brain to grasp that concept of non-duality. It's just not how, well, maybe it is. Maybe it's the way we've been brought up and the way we've been raised in the world to think everything else is outside of us. And I think, reading through your interviews, the experiences were very much colored and decorated or flavored by how that person's spiritual foundation in the world. So if someone was a deep had a deep Christian faith, they would find Jesus. If someone is had came like the rabbi came from a deep Jewish faith, it was very Kabbalistic and very Judaic in nature. So there's definitely an element of how we are in the world will reflect what we see on the other side. But it's not the whole answer. I think perhaps it's there to make us feel safe, but it's there is so much more that was very apparent in all of these stories. And you mentioned it in your first book, the message that you got from the little green man was have fun. And it's this experience is mind-blowing. And the message you get is have fun. And really, maybe this is it. Maybe it should be simple. Maybe the message is all there is love. Go and have fun, and we've made life way too complicated. And when you look, when you break it all down, it seems to me, well, that's we've got a little bit of time on this planet. Go have fun and make the most of it, and bring everyone along for the trip. And if that's all there is, hallelujah, frankly.
Well, yes, exactly. And Nikki, one of the reasons I went on this journey to find other stories was that what happened to me in my near-death experience wasn't pleasant. I'm going to put it in that way. I was confused and conflicted by it because the first thing to understand is that a near-death experience is an unwanted experience. You're not searching for it. You're not going on a plant medicine journey. You die. And something happens to you. So the first thing to clear up,
Scary.
exactly. So the first thing is it does not correlate to any religion often. So complete atheists can see Jesus, Hindus may see Mary. So it's very interesting. What is common is that people often, most often, see a figure that represents divine wisdom. Okay, so that's a commonality. Now, in mine, I didn't. I did not see God. I did not see angels. It wasn't comfortable. I was removed from my body and I was floating without a place, without a name, without a knowing, without being anybody or anything, without being woman or human. I was floating, which sounds on some level wonderful, but actually it wasn't. It was quite scary. It was terrifying. Even though at the time it's such so strange to use those words because I didn't really know what it was, but I knew it was an uncomfortable searching place and moving further and further away from really what was my body lying on a bed in Constantia Hospital until I moved further and further and into the outer realms of the universe. And then, as you said, when I came back, and this was when my fight back to life happened. It was very much linked to a huge prayer circle of people. This had been 3 weeks I'd been in a coma, moving further and further away into death. I did see some beings from the other side, but they weren't these beautiful angels or angelic beings. It was a strange and weird man called the Forest Man, as I call him in my book, who gave me odd and unusual messages. And that was a confusion for me as well. That's why I think when I came out of my near-death experience, and you're going to find this is very common, people don't go shouting from the rooftops, guys, this is what happened to me. It was so wonderful because you're confused. Confused. You don't know. You don't even know that you actually died. So very often you're going to go and see in these stories, it took a while for the person to go back and find the records or ask the doctors. It's because nobody says to you, oh, by the way, we resuscitated you 3 times. They don't say that. So it's a slow burn and it's a slow, strange wondering what happened. And I think one of the interesting things in reaching out to so many people who'd had this was feeling this commonality and also that it stepped outside of many religious practices. And you will see in the book, as you did, that an absolute devout Christian was taken by the devil. So that's also a crazy story, right? Amalape.
Yes.
And yes, you're right in that reflection that the devil would have been his lens, right? He was religious, so the polarities he would have seen, what was relatable in the strange, weird realm between life and something for him visually was the devil.
Like you said, it takes a sort of a gestation period from going through the trauma of a coma and having to regain your bodily functions, senses, ability to speak, ability to type, ability to breathe properly on your own. Yeah, I can imagine nobody snaps out of that kind of profound kind of experience and wants to broadcast it because you don't know what you've dealt with. You don't know where you've been. You don't know if anyone's going to take you seriously. And it takes, I mean, you said it took, what, 10 years from going through your experience to writing Love and Above. And then this was obviously a natural progression of wanting to know more, wanting to communicate, wanting to reach out and find other people who'd been through this. How has this book, The Other Side, changed you? Because all books change us once we've written them. What has happened for you in the process of writing this book?
I think the first and biggest profound experience of how a book changes me was writing Love and Above. And what actually happened when I started writing it, I was asked to write. I'm an author, and they said, my publisher said, "Can you write the story? We've heard you talk about it. We've heard people talk about it." From the second I started writing that book, it showed up in my body. I literally lost feeling on the whole one side of my body, and it stayed for the entire few months I wrote the book. It came back in my leg, my arm. Eventually, the feeling came back, but my hand was numb. Because I've worked with authors for so many years, that's my business. I knew that this was a somatic response to trauma, that I was going back, I was getting the diaries out, I was reliving, I was crying, I was going back into the trauma of the coma and those months afterwards. Of course, I also did go and have a session with my doctor saying, "Have I got a brain tumor? Am I, you know, why have I lost feeling?" But there was nothing physiologically wrong with me. And you know, when that book was done and I stood up on a stage and I spoke about it and I spoke about it, something extraordinary happened. That this thing that had lived inside of me, this pain, this trauma, this feeling, was suddenly something. This it was a pro it was in my hand. I'm going to lean up and grab it, and I was talking about it and waving it around. The story that had been inside of me, and it was so awesome. And so many times when I stood on a stage, I cried because it was still this emotionality. This book was such a different experience because this book, as much as I spoke to the incredible people, I was tracking the science and the patterns. This book is easier to talk about. When I'm standing on a stage or when I'm being interviewed, I can talk about this book easily because it's an amalgamation of stories. It's a gathering. It's so personal and heartfelt. And so this is an easier thing. And it's allowed me a relief and a distance from my own, what people would call trauma. And I say trauma like this was a trauma. And I speak in Love and Above about not having post-traumatic stress, but having post-traumatic bliss. I was so hugely happy and grateful for having just being alive that I was just over the moon. So, but this book has allowed calm and reason and distance. And I go, it wasn't all so fabulous, actually. It wasn't just bliss. It was actually a lot more than that. So there's an intellectuality about this book, and there's just an absolute kind of wild ride in this book, and they feel so different.
Absolutely. Yeah, they are very different. And what response have you had? I mean, it's a strange question, but it came to me. How have your kids responded to this journey? Have they been on it with you? I know to an extent you mentioned your daughter and your son quite a lot in the first book. How have they been in the world with you going forward?
So when this event happened in 2012, when my husband died after his 4-year battle of cancer, and I was in this near-death experience, month-long coma, my children were 7 and 9. They were highly, highly traumatized. My son had what I think was 4 years of incredible trauma response, where he would not be more than 2 meters away from me. And my daughter, her pain manifested in different ways. My son is 19 at the moment, and my daughter's 21. And I look at who they've become, and I realize that these hard things we go through in life make us bigger people. It's at points watching their journey as teenagers, I thought, have I done the wrong thing? I went against a lot of advice. At the time, people said to me, keep everything steady, keep your children in school, don't rock the boat, keep them at psychologists, which I was doing, but I had this intuitive sense it wasn't working. And what I did was, back in 2012, 2 years after my coma, I saw the trauma in my children. I pulled both of my children out of school, and we mo moved to a small Greek island for 4 years, where we healed. Part of that is in my first book, Love and Above. What I will tell you is that my son, who's now 19, when Love and Above came out, I gave it to him, and I saw him put it on his shelf, and he has not picked it up once, not once. And I said to him months ago, I said, are you ever going to read it? And he said, I can't. It's too painful for me. But what did happen was, when The Other Side launched and I did a talk, my son came to the talk and he sat in the audience. And I spoke about the journey in a much more calm way. And I spoke about other people's experience and et cetera, et cetera. And my son came up to me afterwards and hugged me. And he said, Mom, that was incredible. He said, I didn't know half of the story. He said, maybe in a few years, I'll be able to read this one. So that I felt amazed by that. And I felt proud because I realized that it's been a huge realization in watching youngsters go through what was incredibly traumatic for anybody to live through, having your father die, your mother nearly die, and watch their own healing journey, and that it takes time. Just takes time. My daughter did it in her way, my son's doing it in his way. And I think these books, for them being able to sit and read them, and I don't think they're going to read them now, Nikki. I don't think so. I think when they're in their 30s, they're going to pick them up. And I think one of the reasons we write books, it's not just to impact people and share the message out there. For me, deep in my heart, it's that I know that these books are going in my children's treasure box, and one day
I love
they'll
that.
read them and they'll have some sense of understanding of their lives, maybe, and a record of their lives. So it's so public and it's also so personal.
That's the thing. That's the push-pull that we all have to deal with, is to be real in the world, but also to keep, a safe and sacred space for those people who matter. It's really like, how do you balance that? That's really important. So you are so clearly divinely guided. And it takes a very strong, brave person to put this out in the world, because you're putting yourself out into a highly critical environment where people are going to love it, people are going to hate it, but it doesn't matter because it's your truth. So I just wanted to acknowledge how brave you are in having gone through what you've gone through and being able to have the gift of the words to put it out there, because it helps so many people and it gives us hope and it makes us realize that we are all part of a greater plan and within a community, and we should be using using the communities we're in as support to get us all through this journey. So I just wanted to acknowledge that first and foremost. And for anyone who's listening to this, and I'm sure anyone who's listening will have their curiosity seriously piqued, is to the first thing you do right now is go out and find a copy of Love and Above. But most definitely, if you've already read that, get hold of The Other Side. Available everywhere, I'm sure, every bookseller you can imagine, all over the world. So there's no excuse whether to get on an ebook or to get your physical book, but do yourself a favor. If you are like so many of us who are just looking for answers, searching for meaning, this is a really good place to start. And it resonates for me. I'm sure it's going to resonate for so many people. So, Sarah, thank you for doing all this amazing work that you do. And where can people who are listening find you if they want to reach out?
Thank you, Nikki. They can find me at sarahbullen.com or theritergroup.co.za.